Okay, on my left are panelists from the Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound Archives. They're going to be introduced by Don McCormick. Don, once again, for those of you who might have missed it at 9 a.m., is the chair of our local arrangements committee. Don is the curator of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound Archives, and he's also a past president of ARSC and a member of the ARSC AAA committee, a great supporter of ARSC, and someone who music librarians like myself look to for leadership and opinions and so forth. So let's welcome Don McCormick and his panel.
Thank you, Holly. Hello again, and welcome to a panel presentation on the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound. Adrian?
I think the strange, the crazed, the queer will have their holiday this year. I think for just a little while there will be pity for the wild. I think in places known as gay, in clubs and cabarets and bars, Pierrot will serenade Pierrot with frantic drums and sad guitars. I think for some uncertain reason mercy will be shown this season to the lovely and misfit, to the brilliant and deformed. I think they will be housed and warmed and fed and comforted a while before with such a tender smile the earth destroys her crooked child. One I kept, two I lost, three is sheltered under frost. One I tired of, two still wanted, three the starry meadows haunted. One was faithful, two was clever, three stayed in my heart forever. Yes, lately the place has grown wilder because of neglect, or maybe because the winds take more liberty with it. I walk out the door a little bit drunk after supper to watch down the valley 5 miles off, even 10, the rainstorms advancing like armies of tall, silent men. Pito, our pony, has caught in his nostrils the scent of those storms coming. When Pito was born, he stood on his four legs at once and accepted the world. He was wiser than I. When Pito was 1 year old, he was wiser than God. Pito, Pito, the Indian boys call after him, trying to stop him, trying to stop the wind.
What you just heard was taken from a set of 10 cardboard acetate discs with a Voicigraph label, recorded in 1948 in a penny arcade in New Orleans by Tennessee Williams and a friend of his known to history only as Pancho. These 10 discs came to this library as a gift from a friend of Tennessee's and wound their way into the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound. I pick that particularly as a thing to begin the panel presentation today, and I'm very happy to introduce to you three of my senior staff members that I'm going to turn the show over to. From left to right, Mark Tollison, who is the assistant chief of the archives, Sarah Velez, who is a reference librarian and print materials librarian and has been with our archives for 14 years now, despite her youthful appearance, and Adrian Cosentini, who is the chief sound engineer of the archives. They're going to basically talk to you and leave you lots of chances to ask questions about everything you ever wanted to know about this archive or any archive and were afraid to ask, I think, is what the panel is about. But particularly, I wanted three of my senior staff to be out here and tell you what they do and what the running of an archive, as big and significant as this one, is all about. I offered each of them a chance to pick something from the archive that was particularly memorable to them or had some meaning to them, and you just heard mine. So without further ado, I'm turning it over to Adrian Cosentini. Thank you.
Good morning. Okay, I'm going to try to briefly explain what I do here. Sometimes it's a pretty difficult job. I once heard a relative, my wife, her explanation of what I do here is that I play records and I make tapes of dead people. I told her it wasn't quite accurate. I'll start telling you what I really do here. There's roughly $1 million worth of audio and video equipment that I'm responsible for, and there's roughly 500,000 recordings that I have to preserve or make available to the public. Since the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives are a part of the New York Public Library, one of our main responsibilities is to serve the public. My job in this part of the operation is to keep the playback system in operation. And the playback system consists of 9 turntables, 4 reel-to-reel tape players, 2 analog cassette decks, 2 CD players, 3 VHS video decks, 1 video laser disc, and last but not least, 12 listening booths with all the necessary interconnecting hardware. The most important part of this equation is the 2 full-time and 1 part-time technicians that I'm also responsible insofar as training and supervision. And now I'll explain a little bit about on the preservation end. I'm responsible for the supervision of 3 engineers who do preservation work. I also work at making preservation copies for the archives. The types of materials I've worked on are cylinders, 78s, acoustic and electric, wires and tapes, and my specialty, electrical transcriptions, or ETs. Now, if you didn't know, ETs come in a wide variety of styles. To name a few, we have 16-inch discs, 12-inch discs. They come in aluminum base and glass base acetate. Since we have such a large archive, we have to make critical decisions about what gets preserved first. Part of that decision is based on what the materials happen to be and how fragile they are. And in the context of fragile, the glass-based acetate comes out on top with the aluminum-based acetate running a close second. One of the misconceptions about the archive is the kind of materials we collect. Since it's called Rodgers and Hammerstein, a number of the people I've met in my career think we have nothing but copies of Carousel, Oklahoma, and South Pacific. And some other people think we have nothing but Metropolitan Opera broadcast and Toscanini performances. But we do have them. However, there's a few other things we have. I always feel that one of the best-kept secrets here is the collection of classic pop and jazz that we have. And that's usually where I have my most fun. Just to mention a few of the collections that I've worked on that fall into that category, we have the Leo Reisman collection, the Lenny Hayden collection, and the Raymond Scott collection. Now, out of that, the most delicate and fragile of these is the Raymond Scott collection. 3/4 of this collection, which I estimate to be around 300 discs, give or take a few, most of this collection was glass-based acetate and the rest was aluminum. When this collection came to us, it was evident that it was stored in very poor conditions. In other words, it sat in a flooded basement of a warehouse in Farmingdale, Long Island. Now, the worst casualties of this wonderful storage, one of the biggest problems I found is that the acetate is peeling off the base on a number of these to varying degrees. Some of them, the acetate was just peeling off a little bit on the edge, which isn't a too big a problem. And some of them, the problem was a little worse, like this. So, and let me see. Well, we won't get a chance to hear that one today. But that's an example of the worst one that I came across. I found when I was working on this collection, it's chock full of some really great performances, live radio performances. To name a few, we have Frank Sinatra, Stan Kenton, Johnny Mercer, Joe Safford, Dorothy Collins. And there's all sorts of radio performances by Raymond Scott, from his quintet to his double quintet and his orchestra. And I'm going to play a couple of examples. And if we have more time, I'll play even more. But what I have here first is this was a premier performance of, both of them, a premier performance of Raymond Scott compositions. The first one was from April 8th, 1942, on a program called Powerhouse. And the second one you'll hear is from July 4th, 1944, and that's from a Raymond Scott show. I'm only going to play a little bit of them, but here they are.
It's time now for our one-man composer's corner, with the world premiere performance of Raymond Scott's latest tune. With the papers and radio news full of war and spy activities, to say nothing of a rash of movies dealing with undercover specialists, Mr. Scott has himself become spy-minded. Witness the title of his new number for this week, Secret Agent. Nobody but the boys in the orchestra have heard this number so far, and they've heard it only because of obvious reasons, so we can't tell you anything about it. Here it is, Secret Agent. America's number one composer with a band introduces a new rhythm number. Raymond Scott and his orchestra play, for the first time on the air, The Lark Leaped In. Raymond?
That's a little taste of what's in the Raymond Scott collection. Getting back to preservation, so far all the preservation work done at the archive is still done using analog equipment. The recordings you just heard were made using a Technics SP-15 turntable with a custom-made bass to accommodate the 16-inch discs, an SME 3012R tone arm fitted with a Stanton 500AL cartridge. And for the preamp, I use an Owl 1. And when I do use filters, and I use them very conservatively when I do, I use a URE 565 or an Orband 642B. And the reel-to-reel recorder that I made the preservation tape on is an Atari MX-55. This wasn't from the preservation tape. This was directly from the disc, and I used that using the Panasonic SV3900 that's sitting right there. So that's a digital recording of the discs. And also, to be a little bit more scientific about what I do, I use a spectral analyzer and an oscilloscope to make sure that what I'm hearing is really what I'm hearing. And after you get off the subway sometimes, that's not always very accurate. Okay, now getting back to the scientific, I believe that it's of the utmost importance that preservation work should be approached in an objective and a scientific manner. And granted, some of the decisions in the transfer process are made on a subjective basis, but I try to keep those at a minimum. Too often I've come across transfers that don't do justice to the original just because somebody let their ego get in the way of the recording. My work should be as transparent as possible. I always try to keep in mind that most of these old recordings have a lot of good sound in them, and it's my job to reveal it. Unfortunately, to many engineers and producers, think that if it's old, there's something wrong with it and they've got to fix it. As the chief engineer for a major sound archive, I have to seriously concern myself with the relentless advances in technology. Currently, most of the major archives of the world have agreed to keep in the analog domain. I believe that sooner or later, all the major archives will have no choice but to go digital. In my freelance jobs, I've done work with digital editing and digital signal processing. In this regard, the digital way has proved itself to be superior. The jury, however, is still out when it comes to long-term storage, but there are some interesting possibilities on the way that I'm looking into. And that's basically all I have to say. And if you have any questions, are we taking questions now or at the end of? Yeah. Oh, okay. If you have any questions, I can answer them. Maybe. Yes.
What are the interesting possibilities that you're looking
into? CDR primarily. That's one of I've come across some studies that look pretty interesting, insofar as the longevity. They seem, you know, a little more testing has to go along, but I'm pretty confident that the manufacturing of CDR has really come a long way since the original CD manufacturing, and I'm pretty optimistic that pretty soon we'll be able to use CDR for archiving. Yes.
How confident are you in the long-term storage capability of DAT at this point?
So far, well, I'll tell you, my personal experience with DAT, there's a few parameters that have to be taken into consideration. First of all, that you record at either 44.1 or 48K, not 32, and that you do it on a professional machine, and that you're using good tape. I use the Sony professional tape because, from my understanding through the manufacturers, they test every one of them. So now, given that, I feel that a DAT could feasibly last about 10 years. Now, I have DAT tapes that I've made about 10 years ago, and they still play. Okay, I've come across some DAT tapes that I made 3 months ago that don't, but they weren't made under the circumstances that I just described to you. So I'm not going to say that they're going to last you as long as a reel-to-reel, but if you want something to last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, a DAT, you know, I feel pretty confident that'll be all right.
One point I'd like to make regarding that is that we do have two specific and different functions here. One is public service, which is very important to us, and the other is the archiving. So when we're talking about looking into these other formats, most of the time that is going to be for public service copies, not our archival stuff, so that ideally we would have an analog and a digital copy, an analog preservation copy and a digital service copy. We're not to that point yet, but that's what ideally we'd like to do.
Yeah, well, as of now, if we're making a, I mean, I'm speaking more personally now. What we do here in the archives, we do everything on analog, and until I hear otherwise, that's what we're going to be doing. So I don't know how long that's going to happen, but once again, as with all archives, we're going to have to face the reality that it can't stay that way. We're not going to have a choice at a certain point in time. So, yes.
Along those lines, on reel-to-reel tape, have you run into much problems with the sticky tape syndrome?
Yeah. In fact, we're working. We've discovered one of our collections. We do have that problem. We've been able to get every single one of them to play back so far, using pretty bizarre methods. But we've gotten them to play back. So I mean, once you find that problem, and, you know, especially in this collection or a private collection, once you find, I mean, the only alternative you have is to try to get it to play back and make another copy of it, because it's just a matter of time before you can't at all get it to play back. So that's one of my favorite problems. That and wire recordings. Yes.
Could you amplify your statement that you use oscilloscopes and electronic signal analyzers to make sure that you're hearing what you really think you're hearing?
Oh, sure. Basically, I mean, I use the oscilloscope to make sure that all my connections are proper and that it's in phase. And if I have I'm remastering an old tape, to make sure the phase on the tape is proper. And if it's not, I make the necessary adjustments. And the next thing is my spectral analyzer. The spectral analyzer is a very useful tool. This way I know exactly what the amplitude is of every single frequency in relationship to all the other frequencies. So, I mean, if I come in one morning after being battered on the subway and my ears are a little bit on the racked outside and I'm not hearing the high ends as well as I should be, I won't be making a recording which is like completely exaggerated on the top end, for example. Or, I mean, one has to take into consideration, you know, one's physical limitations at any certain point in time. And I always have to laugh when I hear engineers come into a situation and they're for all intent and purposes, they're stating that they have the quote-unquote golden ears. Well, I don't know what that is. I mean, I've been in the audio business for about 20 years, and I would never make a claim like that. That's insane. So,
just a quick interjection there too, is that I think most people that use the subway stop here at Lincoln Center agree that it's the loudest one in the city. It must be. It's excruciating. It really is. So.
Anyway, Sarah's turn.
Okay. As the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound is part of the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, we are actively involved with both research library activities as well as museum exhibitions, which help to open up our collections to the public. Our collecting policies reflect both the scope of a research institution catering to the specialized needs of scholars, as well as a public library dedicated to serving the general public. The users of our collection are therefore a diverse group, which includes professional musicians such as composers, conductors, instrumentalists, and singers, as well as actors, choreographers, dancers, music students, and writers of all sorts, such as critics, discographers, historians, whatever. We also serve the general public, who may need material that is not available in our circulating collections. We answer reference queries by phone, mail, and in person. We frequently receive requests for copies of our recordings, especially old popular standards on 78s. People are often looking for music to celebrate wedding anniversaries or would like to hear early recordings of their close relatives. Also, people may need certain recordings for serious study purposes. If the material requested is for personal research only and cannot be obtained either at in-print or out-of-print dealers, we will agree to make copies for them, charging them a fee. If the material requested is going to be used for commercial purposes, such as in a movie or TV program, permission must be granted by the copyright owner of the recording before we will make a copy. Our collections are comprehensive and international in scope and can be accessed by card and book catalogs for our earlier acquisitions and by national and local databases for our later acquisitions. With regard to recordings, we collect in every format, on every aspect of recorded sound, from its cylinder beginnings to its present digital state. We also collect videos dealing with various musical subjects, except for musical shows, which are collected by our theater division. We do not make copies of any of our video material. Besides our audiovisual material, we have an extensive print collection, which consists firstly of discographies of composers, performing artists, record labels, etc. Many of these discographies can be found on our local discographic database, which is constantly being expanded by our staff, who index discographies found in books, magazines, bibliographies, etc. The print collection also includes rare early record company catalogs, as well as current catalogs. We collect monographs and serials on every aspect of recorded sound, including its earliest history, as well as current up-to-date material, always keeping an eye open for the latest trends, interests, and needs of our present public, as well as envisioning what could be of use for future researchers. Serving on the public reference desk greatly aids engaging the beat of the times when acquiring material. As an example, for the past few years, there has been a notable increase in people doing research in Latin American pop music and African pop music. Thus, I have been trying to acquire more discographical and historical material in these areas, as there had been a paucity of sources previously. To give an example, in the last few years, we have purchased two very fine encyclopedias of popular music, the Guinness Encyclopedia and the Penguin Encyclopedia, which have very good listings for Latin American and African musicians, including recording information. Other contemporary titles which have proved helpful in these areas are African Music by John Gray, The Da Capo Guide to Contemporary African Music by Ronnie Graham, Reggae and Latin Pop, Hot Sauces by Billy Bergman, and World Beat by Peter Spencer. A magazine that has particularly turned out to be a gold mine for information regarding Latin music and musicians is Latin Beat, some of which copies I have left out here if anybody wants to take a look at them, which regularly produces wonderful historical articles on early Latin performers such as Mario Bauzza, Chano Pozzo, Machito, and Arsenio Rodriguez, as well as great features on more contemporary people such as Tito Puente, Eddie Palmieri, Willie Colon. It also published specials on Latin women in music, featuring performers such as Celia Cruz, Zoraida Morey, Mirta Silva, and Graciela. Another magazine, and I also left out a few copies, The Beat, has great coverage of popular African, Caribbean, reggae, and world music. Much to our delight, in the same vein, we recently received a gift from the family of Dr. Jose Famadas of Puerto Rico, a collection of 2,000 LPs of Latin American popular music from different countries. We are now indexing the collection on a local database with access points for artist, title, country, record label, and number. Eventually, we hope to fully catalog the collection, but till that time, the collection will be given class marks and will be made fully accessible to the public. To give you a further idea of the scope of our print collection, we have material in many languages, including Bulgarian, Danish, Dutch, Finnish, French, German, Italian, Japanese, Polish, Russian, Spanish, Swedish, etc. For the past few years, I have been avidly trying to enrich our holdings in early historical sound recording magazines from all over the world. Through my dealings with an international microform publisher, I have been able to obtain early magazines from Czechoslovakia, France, Germany, Lithuania, and Russia. Some of these titles, just to give you an example, are from Czechoslovakia, Grammotechnique from Prague, 1929 to 1932. From France, we were able to get Phonocine Gazette from Paris, 1905 to 1908. From Germany, Unterricht und Sprechmaschine from 1908 to 1914. From Lithuania, Musikalnaya Echo from Vilna, 1914. And from Russia, we have Gramophone e Phonograph from St. Petersburg, 1902 to 1907. Another one is Gramophonaya Zhizn from Moscow, 1911 to 1912. Gramophone Mir / Die Gramophone Welt, because it's in Russian and German, from St. Petersburg, 1910 to 1917. Pishushi Amor from St. Petersburg, 1914 to 1916. And Navosti Gramophona from St. Petersburg, 1907 to 1908. These international serials from the early 1900s are truly valuable research sources. They include early gramophone industry news, listings of popular recordings of the times, record reviews, sketches frequently with illustrations of early recording artists, histories of early record factories with wonderful illustrations, colorful gramophone and record label advertisements and cartoons, articles documenting the use of early talking machines in studios, homes, schools, halls, hospitals, dance classes, etc. One interesting example that I came across was the use of early gramophone recordings in Russian monasteries for the monks to improve their singing techniques. These early magazines are really wonderful and are truly a barometer of the social and musical tastes of their times. Now, as a change of pace, Don has asked us to choose something unique from our collections to play for you. I was recently looking at one of our monographs, Federico Garcia Lorca y la Musica by Roger Tinnell, and I remembered that we had some early recordings of Garcia Lorca's harmonizations of Spanish folk songs. In 1931, his master's voice, Spain, released five recordings of these folk songs with Garcia Lorca playing the piano accompaniment and Encarnacion López Hulves, better known as Argentinita, singing, dancing, and playing the castanets on the recordings. These are the only known recordings of Lorca's playing, none ever having been found of his voice. I would now like to play for you two of the folk songs performed by the great Spanish poet and playwright Garcia Lorca and the renowned singer and dancer Argentinita. The two songs are El Café de Chinitas y Sorongo Gitano.
En el campo. dell'amore, t'involo sto con la nulla, t'involo sto con la nulla, di il corato si ti guanca la pietà della lumbre. De noce mi salgo al patio, i me hanno di chiamar, se vergetta chi ha lo tanto, i tu la vecchia renna. De noche me salgo al patio y me harto de llorar, de vergüenza quiero tanto y tú no me quieres nada. Esta gitana está loca, loca de la malandar, que lo que sueña de noche quiere que sea la verdad. Esta gitana está loca, loca de la malandar, que lo que sueña de noche quiere que sea la verdad.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions?
Are there any questions? Yes.
You mentioned your policy about copying LPs, and I think anyone who has published LPs in their collection inevitably runs up against patrons requesting copies for personal use. To what extent do you try to determine whether something is in print or out of print, and do you make suggestions to them about what other places they might?
Yeah, we do. If for in-print material, we search right away for them on a CD-ROM. To see what's currently in print. So we can usually tell them right off the bat if it's in print or not.
Phonolog
on CD-ROM. Yeah, the Phonolog CD-ROM.
Hard copy and Schwann catalogs.
Right. Oh, that's right, and the Schwann record catalogs. If we don't find it, and we're unable to find that it is in print anywhere, we give them a listing. We have a very nice listing, two-page listing of out-of-print record dealers in the Manhattan area. Some of them are really quite knowledgeable, very good, and they deal in all sorts of types of recordings.
And that list is on the table if
I think we left a sample outside. And we recommend that they call the dealers and first try to get it in print. And they do. And they usually come back to us from the dealers if they can't find it. And that's when, if they cannot find it and it's not going to be used for a commercial reason, it's for personal research, we will then agree to make them a copy. But, you know, first they have to decide they want to pay our fees. Our fees are not cheap. Especially for LPs. Most people do not want a full LP. That would be rather expensive. They usually ask for a few cuts of 78s. That's the most common request. Though there have been times when they needed a whole LP, right. But that's more.
We've done that.
And we've done it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've done that.
Yeah, you've done it.
The key is.
You try to determine whether it's been reissued and it's available that way? Or
yeah. Oh, yeah. If it's been reissued, we won't do it. We won't do it.
The key issue here for us is a good faith effort to find out whether it's in print or not. And most of the copyright law, they have those little things, good faith effort, and a lot of the different sections, so that if you've really made the effort,
Yes.
Along the same lines, I'm wondering whether you're overwhelmed with requests. If a millionaire comes along and brings you a list of 1,000 out-of-print recordings of Mozart, are you going to take the time to duplicate all that?
No, because we make very limited recordings for the public, because our preservation staff is very actively involved with doing our own preservation work. This is just one of a minor thing that we do, and we do not. We can only accept what our staff can do, and it's very small. And it's usually very small. Yeah.
And as a rule, we won't do a whole LP for somebody. Someone has to come in and need a song. Of course, if one cut on an LP or something like that. Of course, if it's a long work, covering a complete LP, we will do that. But not say if you've got four or five cuts on a side of pop songs, we generally won't do a whole LP just like that, individual cuts.
Case by case decisions, or do you have a definite policy?
Well, we like to leave ourselves discretion, but our policy is that we don't do a whole LP. Someone comes and says, I want the whole thing both sides. Well, no, we don't really do that. Or the couple of cuts that you really need, and we start with that. If they have a really, really compelling reason.
Yeah, sometimes it might be an opera that has not been reissued, and the only place they can get it is on an early LP, and it hasn't been reissued anywhere else, and they can't get it. I remember a request like that for a singer who was studying it. Then we would do something like that. Yeah, that is a real research need for it.
And of course, they do sign a waiver exonerating us. You know, as
as far from as any copyright problems. Right. They do sign. They have to sign.
Do you find the record industry people breathing down your necks in this regard at all, since they're right here at town?
No.
Not really.
No, we haven't had any problems along those lines at all.
Often, actually, some of them are so sloppy with their own archiving that they come to us in desperation for the last copy of some of the things that they would like to re-release, so that's...
And the TV people hit us a lot. They're constantly asking us for material.
In answer to that one, I'd like to add, in all my years here, I have been called a few times by record companies themselves saying, why have you referred people to us? Why don't you just go and do it, please, and leave us alone? So that's basically the answer a great deal of the time. They don't like having public call them and saying, can I get a copy from you, of course, of something that's 20 years out of print, because they don't have it in their archives, that kind of thing. Right, so... what Sarah's been saying, and Mark has been backing up, is that we screen people carefully verbally in person or over the telephone if this is indeed a thing like Sarah said. For instance, Emma Nevada, she was named because she was born, she took that name because she was born in Nevada, she came from Nevada, et cetera, and they were doing some centennial celebration in the town she was born in, and they wanted to have copies of some of her recordings to play for the centennial celebration. Well, that's pretty much it. You know, well, who's gonna worry about such a thing? I mean, it's really not a problem. And we don't copy full LPs unless there's a reason to do that, as Sarah said, and those reasons are usually research or professional and not commercial, and so that's the answer to that. No record company is gonna worry about any archive giving a tape copy of Russ Colombo doing something because the kid's grandparents danced to it when they were dating and before they got married, and he needs a copy of it. There's no record company in the world that's gonna ever come down breathing hard on an archive's neck to do this kind of thing. It's all interpreted through verbal interviews by staff who are at the reference desk for many years, who know what they're doing. That's the answer to that one, really.
I think you might liberalize your policy a little bit and just use the whole process as a money maker.
We're too busy trying to do our own preservation work.
We don't have the staff for that kind of operation.
Additional staff?
Well, that's a large if, though, isn't it? For most institutions, that's a very large if.
One more question.
British Museum has a system in their carrels where there's a captive cassette recorder, a cassette that can't be removed, so that the person who's listening to the recordings can make the recording so that the guys down in the basement only have to play it once and then they can manipulate it. That would be a way, of course, to make the recording that after rights would be cleared, that captive cassette could be given to the customer, and therefore that wouldn't use any more of your staff time. And since the cassette could not be removed or given to the customer until rights have been cleared, then you'd be able to kill two birds with one stone. They'd be able to get a copy of the recording. You would only have to play it once down in the basement instead of playing it the two or three times that they might need it, and they would then be able to continually manipulate it, and then the recordings could be could be obtained by the by the patron.
Okay, I'm Mark Tollison. I'm Don's assistant, which roughly translated means I do all the things that he doesn't want to do. But I love my job here, I really do. I take it seriously, and I take what we do here seriously, and so I do love it. Basically, I coordinate a lot of things of the day-to-day operations of the division. I supervise all the personnel, basically. I keep the reference room flowing, hopefully, in policies, work with policies and procedures and standards, and keeping everyone abreast of what's going on in our reference room. I help Don with some budgeting, ordering, what have you. Just a lot of background work, basically. But I also do reference work, which is very important to me, on the reference desk. The reason the archives exists, it was an offshoot of the music division. At one point, it was part of the music division here at the library. And I think RCA, Columbia, I'm not sure who it was, started giving 78s to the collection many years ago. We are now part of a library that builds itself as a performing arts center, so that was the initial point, was to collect sound recordings of performing arts. For a few years, because of some special collections that have come our way at times over the years, and with actually, specifically as a policy, we did collect a good bit of spoken word recordings over the years. Now we are back to trying to focus on the performing arts as much as we can. One of the problems with a media collection is that it's not a subject collection. So, and when you become the depository for all the media of an institution, it becomes very difficult. You've got other divisions all over the library system wanting sound recordings, but having nowhere to put them, nowhere to play them, and trying to give them to us. So what has happened now is the media is starting to move out into other divisions of the library system so that we can go back and focus specifically on performing arts and leave other divisions to play their spoken recordings of one kind or another for other people. We have our two major focuses. One is, of course, archiving the things, and the other is making them available to the public, and that is our major challenge, is to try to balance those two things. Because, of course, many of our recordings, as we play them, we are wearing them out. 78s we do play for people as they come into, because there's no way we could ever dub them all onto tape, you know, and they are, of course, they are inert, and they will sit there forever and ever, and with our modern playback equipment, they don't suffer too much damage as we play them for people. It is the later media that we're more worried about, specifically some of the reel-to-reel tapes that were put out through the 60s, I guess. That's where the sticky tape problem did come up, I think. And then, of course, the CDs. No one is promising CDs beyond, well, the most hysterical people say 5 years, and the most promising people say anymore, maybe 40 years or something like that at the outset, I think. As far as how long a CD might last. So, at this point, we do play back all of our 78s and our videotapes we do play back. We don't keep service copies of those. Those have turned out to be very fragile, though, I'm afraid. The video cassettes don't do too well. We're also collecting video discs, which, of course, laser rot was a big problem with those about 10 years ago. I think that has been conquered now, but who knows? Who knows how long those are going to last? Now, as far as the reference work we do here, we get about 7,000 telephone calls a year, 7,000 people walk in the door here a year, and we also take reference letters. Anyone can walk in here and get information from us. We're pretty loose about it, and we're committed to public service in our division very much. But of course, when we get to more difficult requests and what have you, and especially with the copying things for people, we do begin to push them more and more and say, okay, exactly why do you need this? Or not why, but try to find out that doing some serious research as opposed to just pleasure listening, although we do have plenty of that. We do feel it's important. When you hear someone interviewing a performing artist, one of the questions they always ask is, who were your influences? So we consider that an important thing. A lot of people that come in here are doing what looks like pleasure listening, but as far as we know, you know, they're listening to people, they're gaining insight into performance practice, they're being inspired, and they might go out there into the world and become very important to our field, musicianship. So balancing those two things is very difficult. Ideally, we would have a service copy of everything and an archival copy. Unfortunately, we can't, so we do as well as we can, given constraints of space, staffing, and money, specifically. When push comes to shove, of course, preserving the content is what we're about here. We want to save the sound recording and the content of the sound recording, not the format itself. But we do get a lot of interesting packaging with some of the later CDs, and of course we have picture discs. And we would like to keep some examples of every format we can get a hold of. So we do have a large body of the really strange, well, not a large body, but a collection of the very strange and unusual formats that we don't service, and many times we don't even dub. They just sit there, and we're just saving them for posterity in their original format. But of course, if the original carrier is going to deteriorate, then, you know, we'll copy it and just let that go, because, again, we don't have the space and the time to really take care of some of the more fragile things and to try to preserve them in perpetuity. We have about 18 staff members. Six of those are full-time professional librarians. One important aspect of our structure here is that our cataloging staff, we do all of our own cataloging, they also do reference work. And I think that's important because you're a better reference librarian if you are a cataloger and vice versa. Because if you catalog, you know how to find things. And if you do reference work, you know how people are looking for them. And so we like to maintain that structure here, although it would be nice to have 10 people that just sit in a room and catalog all day and do nothing else so that we can take care of our rearages, because unfortunately we have a lot of them. But I think it works well this way, so we like it like that. 18 people overall, with five of those people are sound engineers, working with the sound recording specifically, either as engineers preserving and copying things or working the playback line for the people that come in to listen to what we have. Well, that's a quick overview of what I do and just some things I wanted to point up about how we do things here. We have about 5 minutes for general questions about any of the things that we spoke about. All the way back.
You mentioned that RCA and some other companies have donated 78s to you. Have you acquired any original metal parts like stampers to old recordings? And if you have, do you get involved in restoring them or having vinyl pressed from them?
Adrian?
Well, I know there's a couple of original metal stampers in the Toscanini collection, but other than that, but insofar as restoring the metal stamper, it's pretty solid. So we haven't thought it was going to fall apart yet. So it's kind of sitting there. but there's been no request from RCA to do anything with it either, or the Toscanini Foundation legacy, whatever. So.
Do you volunteer at all in the library?
They do in this building, although we haven't really used any up in the Rodgers and Hammerstein archives.
We have no room to put them.
Have you put any of your research references online for remote access, your general catalog, specialized catalogs, or anything else?
Okay, we are on the internet now, and our OPAC can be accessed through the internet. If you telnet to Nipplegate, I'm not supposed to pronounce it that way, NYPL Gate. They don't like it, so they've told us to say Nipplegate and just spell it out. And you go downtown and the bigwigs are choking on it, trying not to say it like we all want to say it. So actually, I think, someone correct me if I'm wrong, is it just nipple.org is the telnet address for the, do you know? Nipplegate.org. And then you log in as NYPL. And then you will get a screen with a few choices on it. At this point, we don't have a gopher. We just have our OPAC online, the dance catalog. But we're looking at extending a lot of our other things and putting them out there on the internet.
Three-part question. Any plans of putting the Mapleson recordings that you issued on LP on CD? If so, do you plan to use any digitalizing, filtering, or anything like that? And what about the Toscanini Salzburg recordings? Are you involved in releasing those in form?
Don? There are no plans at the moment to re-release the Mapleson's. They're still very much available on LP, by the way, for any of you who need them. You can order them direct from the archive. They're still being sold through the Metropolitan Opera Bookshop as well. There has been thought that potentially down the road we might want to do a best of the Mapleson's on one CD or something, with going back to the originals and using Cedar and other things. But it's only been talked about. It would take a great deal of money, and there are an awful lot of other things that we need to do, and they're still available on LP. The Toscanini material is heavily restricted because of 25 pages of restrictions that came with the Toscanini legacy, thanks to the Toscanini family. It's been, as any of you who work in an archive that receive gifts from private estates or whatever, you know what kind of a headache that can be. There, certainly Seth Winner and myself, Seth being the person who's worked primarily on the Toscanini legacy here in this collection, and me as the curator working with him, have dreams of 150 to 200 things in that legacy that would be wonderful to see released to the world now. And pretty much, I'm not going to bat an eyelash about saying the Toscanini family is impossible to work with.
The Selenophone material has been basically given a no by the Toscanini family for reissue in any form whatsoever, except for listening purposes in the archive. Some of that, of course, has been available in pirated form before, but we did a wonderful project. If any of you were here in the last few conferences or read the Ars Journal, know that Seth did a terrific job in going back to the film and redoing the whole thing. And we tried. We were hoping to be able to get, and BMG was even a little interested, not a lot, but a little interested in working with us in this, but the Toscanini family ixnayed that. We now have something else in the wind that I can't talk about yet because it's got to go through a lot of channels, but the first and worst part of the family to deal with has already said yes on that one. So we're moving along. We're moving along. There is something we're hoping we'll be able to do, and this one will be on CD, utilizing Cedar and everything else, for the end of 1995. Early 1996, to mark both the centennial of the New York Public Library and the centennial of something else that will be on that disc. So that's my hope in the future, but if you're all hoping that any more of the Toscanini legacy that we have here will get out to the world at large, the answer is a resounding no. You can all come in here and listen to it if you want. Thanks.
We're out of time, but before we go, I have to show you my favorite item. This is a postcard of Richard Nixon, excerpts from Richard Nixon's nomination acceptance speech, August 8th, 1968. I just like this, I don't know, the first time I saw it. And so I love to pull it out whenever I can. If you notice the hole, there's not a hole in his face, it's never been played, the punch out is still there. So it's pristine, absolutely pristine. So we're out of time. We're done, I think.
Yes, we are. Okay, shall we?
Thank you all. I'd just like to add a well done to my staff, so everybody can hear me say it once anyway. Just a quickie before Holly introduces the next speaker. Lunch break will be from 12:30 to 2. You do have suggestions in your folder of places that are within easy reach of here for lunch. Any of you who are interested, the Juilliard Cafeteria is available to all of you if you want to go there. It's a lovely cafeteria. Juilliard's out of session right now, but there are kids from the School of American Ballet and everything using it right now. Most of the library staff go there. It's across the street this way, across 65th Street, the tall high-rise building. Any of you who were here last night who met at the reception, it's that building. And instead of going up in the elevator, you just go in the door and walk straight through beyond the guards desk to the back, and there's a cafeteria there. For those of you who weren't here, you cross the street and look for the outdoor escalator that takes you up to the so-called plaza level of Lincoln Center and turn left when you're off the escalator and walk into the Samuel Rose building and you'll find it. I don't think anybody would be questioned, but it might be wise to have your badges with you. Okay, thanks.